Welcome to episode 6 of Superhero Speak. I wanted to let everyone know that this weekend, May 30th through June 1st, I will be at the Wizard World Philly Convention at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. You'll see me walking around in a Superhero Speak t-shirt, so if you see me, stop me and say hello. Speaking of Superhero Speak t-shirts, you know you can now get your own? That's right. Head off to cafepress.com/superhero speak and check out all of our merchandise. Buy something and show your love for our podcast. So, this episode, Ben and I sit down with author Eric Cooper, who is the writer of Nightseeker. We met up with him at the Glyph Awards and were walking around Philly and decided to stop at a Chinese restaurant, have dinner, and record the conversation. So, we're at a restaurant. There's a couple audio issues. Please forgive them, but here we go.
All right, you're listening to Superhero Speak. This is Dave.
This is Ben.
And we have a special guest with us this week, author and creator of the character Nightseeker, Eric Cooper. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Thanks for inviting me out to go eat at the Chinese shop.
Well, whenever you can get Chinese food, right? You're there.
Oh, yeah. I love my Jonestown chicken. Oh, yeah.
So, I guess we'll start off, as any interview should start off, for people who don't know who Nightseeker is, let's start with your character. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Nightseeker is really a college kid from Scripps, New Jersey, so it's Switch, New Jersey, the capital city of New Jersey. And he's a college kid who works part-time for a news station. And while he was working for a news station, he was told to, well, look, Nigel, we got extra money, we got more resources, more permission for our station. And we want you to go out and help install a new station for us at a hotel. And so he goes out with the crew, and he's there at the hotel installing all the equipment. So now it's like about 9 o'clock at night. Everyone says, look, we're wasted, we're going to go home. Nigel, come on. Nigel says, no, I want the overtime. You guys leave, I'll stay at the building by myself, I'm okay. So everyone leaves, he's there. Now it's 2 o'clock in the morning. He's tips, he's ready to go home. And he locks the studio, goes to the elevator to go downstairs, and then there's a crash in the studio. He goes, oh man, hopefully someone installed a spray from the floor. So he goes back into the studio, opens it up, turns on all the lights, and sees there's 2 elements running around. And that's pretty much where everything starts. But mainly, Nigel is turned into Nightseeker from an alien presence, and he becomes a superhero. And he goes around the area trying to be the best hero he can be to protect the guy he loves. And the character has a lot of history to him. They were early all at one time, but as you go to the interview, I guess we go further in.
Cool. So about a little bit about you. You're originally from Trenton.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Trenton, New Jersey. I'm 39 years old now. And I was born and raised there, but also I use that as a back part of my character also, so we're supposed to make up the character.
Right.
And, I love my area. I live on the west side. And it's a nice quiet area. Some of the other sides aren't as great, but, where you live is your home, so you just, you try to make the best out of it. I work at Lynn's Crafters full time. I sell glasses, and I write books at night time. It's a great combination.
Right, you got to do what you love, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Now, Nightseeker is a novel. You have that 1 and 2 out right now. I hear that there's another one coming up.
Yeah, there's number 3. But actually, they're not just novels. We actually classify them as caption novels.
Okay.
The reason why we say that is because at the beginning of each chapter, there's an illustration that gives an idea of what's happening in chapter 3 read into it. So when I did the very first novel, Nightseeker, it was all text. And my readership would say, dude, we see just such movie potential, a big comic book potential for your character.
Right.
I said, we're going to do a second book. I said, we want to see pictures. I said, well, I'm not a comic book artist. I don't have time for that. I just want to do novels. So I said, look, I'll make a compromise. How about if I put illustrations in the chapters? I said, that sounds like a good idea. So, because the thing is, we have illustrated novels, you'll have you know, pretty much illustrated novel is our graphic novel is a bunch of comics pressed together to make one book.
Right.
We have an illustrated novel, which is mainly pictures in certain parts of the book, not really formatted in a certain direction. So to have a caption novel, I had to change the terminology of it, is that you have to have beginning of each chapter before you go into a chapter.
Right.
And that's the caption novels, what I teach now, actually, in certain schools, certain conventions, I teach the caption novel format.
Right.
And people love it. But the third book, it takes place actually here in Philly, where we are today.
Okay.
And it deals with a guy called the Guillotine. And he's actually EMT. Now, the fun part about the whole thing about the character is that I wanted to bring back like the olden days, like the old style of executions.
Okay.
And you know, to bring back like more like the older characters back in the day. And also, the nice thing about this one is that I'm using the image of Ray Park. If some of you guys know Ray Park,
yes.
Ray Park is Darth Maul, you know, for Star Wars,
of course.
And also Toad, X-Men, and Snake Eyes from the G.I. Joe movies. And he has been a fan of mine for years. When the first book came out, I had no idea how big a fan he was.
Wow.
And so the second one came out, and he like kind of urged me to go to his table.
Cool.
Nice. And he's been loving my work ever since, and I decided to actually make him a character in my world.
Great.
And saying to that, the first novel, actually, Patrick Stewart is in my first novel. He's actually the devil's best friend called Tyler Savage. Avery Brooks, he's a captain of the New York Police Department. And nice fun part for Jonathan Frakes, Commander Riker from Star Trek. He's Kevin Melbourne. He's a Lancet casino owner, of course, crooked as hell. And he's just an awesome role for him. Every time we talk about it, he laughs about it. So it's nice that these celebrities actually really love the characters that I do, that I kind of represent them a way of my mind.
Plus, you already have casting if they make a movie out of it.
Oh, yeah. We're all for that.
Yes. Right, and I mean, that's another thing, because you have the graphic, not the graphic novels, the, what's the term?
Caption novels.
Yeah. Thank you. You have the caption novels, but you also have, there are some comic books that have been put out with Night Seeker in them. I know that I have two of the issues.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, the first one was done by Blair Smith and Keith Thomas. Keith was the writer, Blair was the artist. Mainly, Blair already started doing the work in the comic book. He was already doing the drawings and the coloring, but he had no story to go behind it, or any way to really push plot what he was drawing. So he met Keith Thomas, and they started doing that together. Actually, they surprised me. I had no idea about it being done.
Uh-huh.
And one night I came over for dinner, and he said, "Eric, you know, you got a novel and everything else, but you know what? Lester needs a comic." I said, "You know, one day Eric will pound me for one. One day I'll get one, you know, one day." So then, "Oh, don't worry about it. We already did it. So what are you talking about? Here, boom." So I seen the big, huge, you know, illustrations, you know, right, along my 17, you know, mad at stuff for it to be the comic.
Right.
I just signed off on it. I said, "Yes, do it." You know. But then when we got to the next comic, it was done by a guy named Nick Harris. He's another artist I work with. He's in Georgia. And I said, I wanted a trailer type of comic done for the first novel, because I had an idea for doing a trailer movie for Night Seeker 1.
Okay.
And I said, you know what, let's illustrate it first, and then go one day to hopefully film. So the story, of course, we had about the writing, and also Keith also came in and also did some of the writing for part of the book as well. And you know, it's just fun working with people that they love the work that, you know, that we do. And the fans of comic book conventions, they said, "Man, we want more." So every time I go to comic book conventions, like, it's like fueling me up for more stuff to do in the industry.
Yeah, that's one of the things. I think that's one of the things that drew me to you. When I've seen you at all the conventions, one of the things I really admire is that you promote your books by dressing as your character at the convention. So that's really cool, and you've always got a big smile on your face. You're very approachable. You're just a really nice guy. I gotta say that.
I just keep it fun. Well, my idea is this, because I work in retail, and right, my philosophy is this: if you work with the public, no matter how your job is, it'd be menial or very big,
yeah,
but always keep the idea of a bartender.
Okay.
Anyway, you know, a bartender always makes everybody happy. Keep the drinks filled, keep them smiling, and come back for more.
Right.
And the idea behind doing the character, you know, dressing up as a character for the comic book is just, is because I was already a cosplayer, so that was a natural thing for me already. But being Brian Miller, I'm the first cosplayer that actually has all books out of industry. It was also a plus.
Right.
That no one's really done yet. But also the character's based on me. Another plus no one's done yet.
There you go.
Also being a superhero, I have to build up the character. No one else has that. No creators I know that way have the most clarity. So it was something different. And like I said, it got me notoriety for what I did. But I went through hell to get this far. And you know what? I would trade anything in the world right now because people know what I do.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're at a really good place in your career right now. You know, you got to keep it moving forward, you know? I think one of the things I want to mention, we just came from the East Coast Black Age Comic Book Convention, Click Award ceremony. And I have to say that, from my perspective, not being an African American,
sure.
As far as I know, it was you know, I have to say, you know, number one to listeners, like, it's a good to do stuff like that. Get out of your own skin, so to speak, every once in a while, and do something. You know, I have to be honest, I was a little nervous about coming down, but everyone was really nice.
We agreed that we maybe eat chitlins or something like that.
No, I won't go that far. Just, you know, I'm more afraid that people are going to think I'm there and for the wrong reasons, to misrepresent, and that's obviously not what I ever want to do. You know, I've said this on the podcast before, and I think, you know, an artist, whether you're a writer, an artist, a musician, it's an art about truth. You know, so I'm all about representing somebody's truth. You know, it's very important. So that's why I was a little nervous, but I mean, everyone there was great, really nice.
Yeah, it was friendly. A great show. It was a lot more fun than I had anticipated. You know, because like, I didn't even know what to expect. It was an award show,
right?
Yeah, you know, so I was thinking, you know, the only award show exposure I have is stuff on TV.
And the Emmys or the Academy Awards.
But yeah, it was a lot of fun, man. You know, very, very.
Well,
pardon the pun, colorful.
It just opens up more of the world of what people really do, but they're not recognized for, because we're not part of these big, huge companies like DC, Marvel, or Image.
Right.
But we do have our own fan bases. We have people that really acknowledge what we do, and these ceremonies actually helps out and give people some sense of hope that one day, hopefully, a big company will pick them up and say, look, we seem to be the small community looking into a big community. And the issues that I have when I submitted work to bigger publishing companies is that, well, we love your idea of Night Seeker, but we don't really know how to sell this. You know, we're not used to having like a black superhero character, and we're not sure what to do with them. And so, because we know our audience, and the funny thing about that is that when I'm at the comic conventions, and you know, and someone goes by the table, you know, they'll have like either like a Spider-Man shirt or a Batman shirt on.
Right.
And I asked him, said, "How much love you have?" He said, "Oh, I love my character. I mean, he's the most awesome character in the world." I said, "You ever thought about living outside that character?" He said, "What do you mean?" "Well, you're passing by a character that is superior character. You seem to love the genre." I said, "Well, let's do this. We'll give it to him. I'll read it." I've always been to all my customers. If you still feel as though your character is number one and you don't second guess them, I'll give you all your money back. Cash.
Right.
And they say, "I can't pass up a deal like that." You're really back at, this is how much I believe my product.
Right. Absolutely.
And the funniest part about the whole thing is that, wait, don't you understand that, like, the Hulk are, you're really going to put your character next to mine? Yes, I will. I'll back up totally. And lo and behold, like, if it's like a whole week of convention, I'll see a person back either next day or day after, and they want the second book. The reason being because they said, "I couldn't put down that first book."
Nice.
Right.
"You got me hooked." I said, wait. Hold up. You said that that character is still kind of that, but I. Wait. Those characters are about for eons, and they got through one book, and that's how powerful that is. But one book.
Yeah.
And that's how I get my new fans, and they tell this whole world about.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's great. I think a big part of it is, and just an outsider opinion on the fact is, you are the creator and the writer, and you're passionate about the character, and you have complete control over it. You know, whereas Batman has been around since the 40s. This story has been retold over and over again.
Yeah, and he's a franchise.
And he's a franchise,
so it's been artist after artist. It's been writer after writer. You know, there's this theme at the center of it, but it's not human anymore because it's now just an icon. It's grown over, it's diluted by the fact that so many people have played a part in that and transformed it into what they wanted it to be at the time. You know, whereas, something like Nightseeker, you're controlling that. That's completely your own. And, character and character flaws and all of that fit into that character and make that character more real because you're defining that as a single person.
Well, another thing about it also is this. I don't have to answer anybody but myself.
That's true.
Right.
You know, and I can only find myself also. So the concept, I have much control, but I try to make sure that the fans are happy. But when I'm writing, my main purpose is this. When I'm writing that book, my main thing is this. I look at the book as though I'm seeing the audience watching a film. Do not bore the audience.
Right.
Keep them moving. You want to keep, keep on the edge of the cliff, and let them go. And so the very end is like, next book.
Right.
Nice.
No, it's very true. And I think, also, you hit the nail on the head, right? You're your own boss. You have control. I met Mark Miller a few years ago at a convention in New York, and he wrote Civil War, which got me back into collecting after I'd been out for a long time. It's a great story, but the ending of it always bothered me because they're fighting, the Cap and Iron Man are fighting and going back and forth and forth, and then at the end, Cap just looks around and says, we're causing so much damage. And it just stops fighting.
Yeah, it was a bit of an anti-climax.
Right.
It just sort of dropped.
And then we all know a few issues later in Captain America, they kill Captain America, they kill Steve Rogers.
Right.
So a question I asked him, I said, is that how you envisioned ending that book? And he goes, no, I had a very different ending in mind. I said, you wanted to kill Cap, didn't you? You wanted there to be, because to me that would have been the ultimate ending to the story.
Yeah.
They would have had to go in a different direction in Marvel, but it would have been the ultimate ending to it. And he said yes. And he said, at first they were like, you can kill Cap. It's a great story. And then when it got time to finish up and get ready for publishing, it was like, no. We want to kill Cap off in this book. So keep him alive and then change your ending.
Business got in the way.
Business got in the way of writing a good story.
That's a shame.
Correct.
Right.
And the thing is, with my characters, I always try to keep the responsibility of what I create. Main reason why. In Nightseeker, I guess I would say this for all my writings. I will not break the timeline.
Okay.
I want to be responsible for everything that happens in that world. And also, if I kill off a character, they stay dead.
Yeah.
They don't come back. Unless they're some kind of demon.
Right.
Other than that, they don't come back. So that means I must always be creative, I must always be original on characters.
Right.
But also, it keeps the people coming back saying, how many times can we have a Joker? He's looking at now, and
right.
That man is a kill.
Yeah.
You know, say,
yeah,
Lex Luthor. You know, how far can Lex push Superman not to kill him?
Right.
You know. Nightseeker, now I will say this though, Nightseeker will kill. And it's like, he's superior. Why does he kill? He kill if he has to save another.
Right.
You know, he doesn't like to kill, and actually he cries about it when he kills a character. He will cry about it.
Yeah.
Because it never gets easier.
Right.
But he does what he has to do, like a cop does.
Yeah.
And pretty much that's what Nightseeker is. Pretty much he is more of a I guess, a intergalactic cop. You know, and
right.
I want to say Green Lantern-ish because he's more like a predator.
Yeah,
he's a super hunter.
Right.
So
right.
It makes him very, very different. He has a killer instinct, but he tries to press as much as he can because of his human side.
So, as a hunter, what are his primary targets? Like, what is the model that you come up with for the enemies and the rogues that he has to face?
Well, here's the fun part. In my world, you're dealing with supervillains, but they're, but I wouldn't say like superpowered, like not like like metahumans. Well, I'll say metahumans, but more not like they come from a different galaxy. They're super strong because of this. I don't do that.
Right.
If they are embodied with some kind of super abilities because it comes from the alien technology.
Okay.
There's also mutants in my world that we call them alters. And I won't call them metahumans, I won't call them mutants, I won't call them alters.
Right.
And pretty much as a person is born with a certain ability, but it doesn't really come out of them until you come into teenage years.
Okay.
But also the thing about my alters is this, if they can, you know, if their body can shift, you know, to a different look, they can still go back to human form, they don't stay stuck that way.
Okay.
So they can blend into our society easily.
Right.
We also deal with vampires. We deal with werewolves. We deal with draconis. Everyone says, this is draconis. Well, a draconis is actually a dragon humanoid.
Okay.
But pretty much a rare dragon. And the vampires and werewolves are actually their food source.
Oh,
they keep
okay.
They keep the numbers down.
Right. Interesting.
And a draconis can live for about 1,000 years, vampires 500, and a werewolf 200. And also a draconis, you can't bite another person to become a draconis. You have to be born that way, and also when you're born, you're action eight. When you're born,
okay, that's cool.
They're very different. We start getting more insight in the fourth book. I've already started drafting out those characters.
Okay.
We also have urban legends. I'm bringing back like the Home of the Horse that's coming. You know, bringing that into my world. Other different urban legends that people think about, even Sandman, even the Boogeyman, stuff like that.
Yeah.
We are dealing with those things. And it's just a fun, fun universe that I'm creating, but I kept it based in the real world. It's awesome. Fun.
Sounds like you thought everything out and you set up some ground rules about how things to be treated. And I think, I'm not a writer, but I think that's important.
Definitely, I think that is an important aspect of good writing.
Because, I mean, we've all seen movies or read books where by the time they get to the third book, they contradict the rules they set up in the first book just because they need to move the story forward.
Right.
And also, let's say for Nightseeker, let's say if a battle doesn't ensue and he's mixed up into it, and let's say a building goes down, whatever. You know, in most of the superhero worlds of DC and Marvel, you know, a whole building will go down, and you get things spliced about it. But in Mexico's world, there are people that are hurt around it, are killed.
Yeah.
And he has to carry that burden with him when something like that does happen.
Yeah.
It's the consequence of good and bad that he has to deal with. And most of the other characters don't deal with that. In my world, they did.
Yeah.
And with those consequences, is he... Like, how is he viewed in, say, the eyes of the law?
That's a fun one. Well, law enforcement, they like him. But at the same time, they really can't let him do what he wants to do because certain laws in place work.
Sure, sure.
The human world, you know, he's not... But really, he's actually is deputized as a galactic cop, so actually his authority's over theirs. But he doesn't go outside that boundary and use that card. He still tries to stay within, you know, a human type of, I guess, reality. He doesn't go over that. And even the villains, what I love about the villains that I work with, or that I write, I should say, is that my villains they're not actually, because you did this to me, I'm going to be the villain, I'm going to be the bad guy. They are who they are because that's who they are.
Okay. Right.
Is so their nature. Is who they are.
Self-interest.
Yep.
Yeah. And I appreciate that because I think that's kind of one of the things, probably ever since the 89 Batman movie, where there's this need to tie the origin of the villain into the origin of the hero, or make it connect somehow. Oh, you did this to me, so now I'm the bad guy because you hurt me, super guy. And it's like, well, that makes no sense. I mean, it can sometimes.
It can make sense, and I think it can fit sometimes, but it can't always fit.
Right.
And on the flip side, you can't have a villain who's just evil for the sake of being evil. Most people who are evil are doing so, it's not that they're doing evil, they don't think they're doing evil. They're doing things that for their own self-interest or crossing lines that they feel they're justified to cross.
Well, I'm glad you guys got to that. The reason being I said that is because in the very first novel of Night Secret, I had a character, I didn't know what kind of villain to give him. And I got tired of that, you know, cause and effect deal. Mm-hmm. I'm good, you must be evil because I created you or you created me. So I said, let me do two different things that nobody would ever think of coming together. So with Night Seeker, he's actually this technological super hunter, and with superhuman abilities. As far as his ability goes, I had to really think back. I said, how about we do something back to the past? So I thought about the ancient Mongolian days of Genghis Khan. And I created a character, his name was Warlord Sage. And he had a group of people with him called the Fury. And they also tried to take over parts of China as well. And the Mongols and the Furies met on the battlefield. Now the fun thing about Warlord Sage is that he was a black magic sorcerer. And they knew that he was cursed. And Genghis Khan called him out while they're on the battlefield, and all the armies stopped fighting. They said, look, whoever wins this battle between me and you wins the whole area. So at the end, Genghis Khan took Warlord Sage's head.
Okay.
Now what happens here is that the sword that Warlord Sage carried is called the Soul Taker. And also that sword is made out of black magic.
Yeah.
So you wind up putting Sage's body and the sword into a coffin, and he's laying on the coffin said, do not open this coffin, it's cursed. Mm-hmm. They buried him out of Malaysia, and Zay's archaeologist team found a gravesite, dug it up, and put on a boat going to New York to be studied. Before the boat made the harbor, it was boarded by 10 mercenaries who were paid to go on the boat and to get the sword out of the coffin. Mm-hmm. When they got the sword out, they actually killed one of the crew members with the sword. They resurrected Sage's body. Mm-hmm. Now, he was in damnation ever since he got killed by Genghis Khan.
Okay,
so right. When he came up, he came up on the boat, and pretty much he established himself as the drug lord of New York. He said, well, power, okay, money and everything else, he, instead of being a warlord, it doesn't exist anymore. Because
right.
Now it's present day, they don't exist.
Right, it's a different world.
So, and also when he closes with the story, he takes your memories and also everything you knew. So now he's aware of where he's at.
Oh, okay.
So very, very different.
Nice.
And the thing is, so now you have this warlord with sorcery and demonic powers going up against something that's technological and science fiction-y.
Right.
So you're pretty much clashing the two worlds together in a very different way. Okay. These two had nothing to do with each other whatsoever.
Right.
Nothing to do with each other.
Right.
Very, very, very different.
Yeah.
Awesome. I don't have to read that.
Too bad you don't have another copy of book 1 on you.
Oh, this is in my car.
Oh, okay. all right. Something else that I kind of wanted to touch on. And we can talk about Night Seeker all night if you want.
Whatever
we're
talking about.
But one of the things that we talked about in New York, you have your chart, which shows the amount of African Americans who are representing the comic book industry and versus the population in the United States. And
wasn't really the population of the United States. Mainly that chart, well, the chart was a non-biased chart, and forgive me, I'm not sure who actually developed it, but it was a true take on Marvel and DC. They're the biggest cash cows in history for comics.
That's right, yeah.
And the chart pretty much depicted the people that actually worked for DC and Marvel. They broke down to the writers, to the artists, the inkers, marketing, your workforce for the entities.
Right.
And it broke down in such a way of male, female, and who was male was a male industry. That was a given. That was pretty much about 90%.
Yeah.
And the rest were female. Then when it got to the races of it, pretty much most people are, and if you're not aware, most people understood, it is more Caucasian feel that is hired in this industry. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty much top out at about 82%.
Right.
Then the next lowest to that was Hispanic. And they were about, say, 16%.
Okay.
Asian, about 6%. When it came to the blacks being represented in the industry, it was only about 2.4%.
Wow.
The lowest was 1.4%.
Right.
And I was at, well, and it's still shocking to me when I think about it, as much as far as the black community being black also, is that how much we support these movies, how much we buy all the paraphernalia
right.
they have. Yeah. And you can only hire about 2.4% of blacks in your industry.
Right.
And you guys keep asking yourself, why don't we get more of people of color that really love our stuff to the open stream? Well, when your characters are mainly also mostly white,
yeah,
and you're not hiring enough people to actually give characters of color any real presence in the books,
yeah.
And so, well, why can't we really appeal to this audience? You know, we do support them and go to their movies and everything else, but when it comes down to the end of the day, most of the black community, we're going to just go like, we want to get to our news and everything else. We're not on like the buses or on the subways reading comic books.
Right.
We're reading like Vibe or Vogue or whatever crazy magazine is out there. We're not reading comic books.
Right.
So I don't know what the stigma is, but there are people of color that really do want to work in these industries, but if you're not given a certain way in, we have to build a background and start doing our own.
Right.
Yeah. No. I mean, and that's true. And there are plenty of I won't say plenty. That's not fair. But there are prominent black heroes. Black Lightning, Power Man, Blade. And I had a couple more in my head and it just went out.
Static Shock. Storm, I always said.
And, Storm,
Black Panther.
But
we're still waiting for a movie for him. We're still waiting on a movie.
Yes.
I'll let somebody just do it.
But I think when you have black characters, but they're being written by Caucasian,
right.
Asian, and Hispanic writers, especially a character like Luke Cage, Power, who I don't want to use anything that might be derogatory, but works, lives in the hood, basically, in New York,
yeah.
and protects the people of his neighborhood. White guy who is...
stereotypically depicted.
Very stereotypically depicted.
Especially in the 70s.
And a white guy can't get in his head. He can't understand, the motivations he has. And to a certain extent, but not all the way, because, it's very true that in this country... And there are distinct differences between African American culture and white culture in a lot of ways. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a good thing. It's just how it is, And
reality.
In fact, I have a really good friend of mine that I used to work with in my last job. Older gentleman. He was in African American. He was in the Marines, and then. Came back from Vietnam and was actually in the Black Panthers for a while, and then he went to college, cleaned himself up, and got into programming. But it's funny because we were sitting and talking about this one time, and he did say to me, it's nothing against you, but I will act differently when I'm with my black friends than when I'm with you. And
that's simple.
Right, exactly. That's simple. And I'm like, and I had to ask, was it because you're afraid of offending me or that I won't understand it or accept it? And he's like, I can't explain it. It's just the way that it is because we act differently.
It's probably a mixture of both where, certain things you say around your peers versus, let's say, your grandparents.
Right.
It's more of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you really stop and think about it.
Yes.
Do they get it? You don't want to try to explain everything to them.
Right.
Because it loses kind of meaning.
Right.
But saying that, like, you know, with the black community, it's more like, well, we want to stand for purpose and meaning what we do, mm-hmm. and we want to be represented wherever we go in life. But me being a black writer, and that's another thing about being a writer. I won't be known as a writer,
right.
not as a black writer.
Yes, yeah, I understand that.
You know, because of professionalism. I don't want to use being a black person writing books as being more of a pigeonhole to me.
Right.
Yeah. I want to be known as a good writer. It's nice that we have, you know, black conventions and stuff like that. But I would like to move away from that and say, could we have a multicultural event, a multicultural
right.
Yeah.
That displays all the races. Because even in my work, now, I mean, I'm not trying to point fingers or anything like that, but when I see other black writers or even artists that do an all-black book, I mean, it's nice if you're proud of your race, it's nice if you hold pride with your culture, but you have to understand this, we're all
your audience.
Your audience.
Yeah.
Your audience is very, very small.
Right.
But when I wrote Night Seeker, I dealt with black, Asian, Hispanic, even Native Indian.
Right.
Pakistan. Actually, Pakistan probably has a superhero character that is a mutant in my world.
Nice.
His name is Tigron. And he's a great pick by character. But I don't know anyone else that has a Pakistani character. I'll be the first to do it. And like I said, the world is your palette.
Right.
It really is. The world is your palette. And you've heard of this around it, and maybe put a little sci-fi twist to it to make it interesting. But the thing is, you can't exclude other races because they're part of your market also.
Right.
But also, it's part of the real world. Now, of course, if you're going to do something on a planet where everyone's black, okay, then you clone the planet. Don't clone Earth because it doesn't make any sense because everywhere you go, there's other people of ethics around you.
Right, yeah.
So include them in your writing. Don't just say, oh, it's all black world. No,
right.
I don't know what world you live on, but this is the real world. If you're writing the real world and using real places, use the real people around you. Because that's
your
material.
The world is diverse, and you want to be inclusive.
Right.
Yeah.
But I had mentioned my story just for the fact that if Dennis had never told me that, I would have never understood that in my head. I would have never thought about it. So if I was a comic book writer, I would have never written that into a story.
Mm.
You know? So that's why I think, you know, and I'm not saying it has to be all the time because, you know, I'm not saying white writers should write Superman and black writers should write Black Lightning, but they should try to be more representative in that sense.
If you want to represent realistic experiences, there is something to be said for at least having people of the race involved in the writing process. For instance, with a character like Luke Cage or Black Lightning.
Right.
If you do that in a bubble of an entire, you know, writer's group of white guys, there's going to be a disconnect there as well. But there's not going to be a complete experience. There's not going to be a full character.
Well, here's a funny part. When I was at Dragon, I was at a panel, and the funniest thing about it was that it was called the Urban Fan, How to Write Urban Fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And DragonCon is a great convention. I go down every year for Labor Day. I was over at Atlanta, Georgia. It's a great convention. And during that panel, there was about six writers. And five of them were Caucasian, one was Hispanic. And the one was Hispanic, she's actually from Vegas. And she wrote a very interesting, diverse novel that is with Hispanic community, but also, you know, white, whatever. And it was more like almost like a monster style or zombie and vampire style world in Las Vegas.
Okay.
And actually the Hispanic population were the zombies.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Some were smart, some were, and you know.
That's kind
but of it was very interesting the way she put it. And I said, I heard her, and she talked about the diversity of different characters. Now tell me something, you're writing urban fantasy, where is your urban in your fantasy? Because she's the only one that actually depicted different cultures in the book.
Okay.
You guys haven't done it yet. And they didn't know what to say.
Yeah.
And it was like, they're kind of like speechless. And like, gotcha. Right. If you're going to do urban fantasy, make sure you represent urban fantasy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, you know, and it's funny. I have to admit to being guilty of being a fan. No, I mean, I don't think it's really his fault, but Jim Butcher writes the Dresden Files, and it's an urban fantasy takes place in Chicago, but he doesn't do a great job of representing different races in his novels.
Not thoroughly, you're right. Well, he represents a lot of fake races with fae and vampires
right.
and things like that. But yeah, to my recollection, the only black character I can recall from the series is what's his name? Sanjay? One of the Knights of the Cross.
Right.
Mm.
So.
And then the Hispanic was the mother of his child.
Susan Rodriguez.
Right. So he had one.
He had one Hispanic.
He said 14 books out.
Yeah.
14
books.
14 books. Yeah. And he had one Hispanic character and one African American character in the movie. Right.
And another stereotype.
I think where this goes is this. And a writer addressed a group, the panel that was at, and she asked, "Well, how can I represent other cultures when I'm not aware of like the Hispanic population or like really, or we don't really have that many black friends or whatever?" I said, "Well, if you're a writer," I addressed her personally. I said, "If you're a writer, how hard is it for you, because you go to college, how hard is it for you to actually go to someone in your class that is of a different race and say, look, I need some research, I need to write some stuff about other cultures. Is it possible to go to your home, be around your family for an hour at dinner, and just see what you guys talk about?"
Right.
Exactly.
How hard is that?
Right.
Because if you're doing research for a project that represents part of them,
right,
they want you to table in a heartbeat. They said, "Oh, someone's going to do a little book, actually, you know, like of our kind of lifestyle."
Right.
Oh yeah. Let them come on in. We'll make dessert and everything for them, you know. but it's nearly getting out of your comfort zone.
Right.
And that's exactly the main thing. And you guys did tonight. You got your comfort zone. You went to a black conference convention or a work ceremony.
Right.
And that was stepping outside your zone. You know, I told you guys about it, but you guys said, "No, oh, everyone's not still there. It was nice and fun."
Yeah.
And it was great to see you guys out there.
Yeah, it was, like I said, it was fun. It was interesting. I'm so glad that I did it. And, you know, I'll have fun when I come to the convention tomorrow.
Yeah,
I'm going to probably walk around with my phone and just try to talk to some different people, record that, and string that together for an episode as well.
Awesome.
Yeah, because again, you know, it's not a community that's represented well in the industry,
the mainstream.
But it's funny because you were saying that the black people, they read Vibe and whatnot, but there's actually on the train I take to work every day. There's an African American woman I see in the morning and an African American gentleman I see at night who both read comic books on the train.
Oh,
you know? So I know, I mean, and I have friends from doing the conventions that are African American fans of comic books. They are out there. And that's the problem, is that the industry doesn't realize it, you know. And I do think if there were more black writers writing black characters and writing more, like you said, even just more of a realistic view of the world, there'd be more people reading it, you know? I mean, it's funny, when you look at those, when you look at those group shots of all the Marvel characters, you know, you can quickly point out all the ethnic characters.
You can heartbeat on two hands if you don't.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I'm also forget, though, that the industry is worried about DC and Marvel, and maybe even Image themselves, that their readership is going down. They're not selling as many copies of such and such books.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're still canceling titles left and right, even 52. I heard about the new, like, four of them were canceled already.
Oh, yeah. They'll
be canceling out in August. And they're asking themselves, why can't we get people to read? You know, why aren't they reading like they used to? And the thing is this. where are your more original storylines?
If
you're more original storylines, you might want to start going back into the communities and start looking at that little bubble of yours.
Yeah.
And get out.
Jeff Loeb actually had suggested on Batman on Batman, I heard him say this, that he kind of feels like they should get away from the numbered books altogether and just come out with, you know, he said maybe even you do it as a 12-part story, or just maybe even just do it as a 3-part story here and there, and just do, but
a do telecomplete story.
Tell a complete story. Tell a complete story. Mm-hmm. You can do whatever you want because you can treat it as a pocket universe and write something creative within there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a great idea because it also gives them the freedom to introduce more characters as well. Mm-hmm. And stop. Take 3 months off of putting out a Batman book. You know? Because if you take 3 months off and then all of a sudden come back and do Batman again, then people are going, oh, I haven't seen them in 3 months. Well, but they're not looking at those things. You know, they're looking at business as usual. How do we
They're sticking to the model that they've stuck to for
eons.
Yeah.
And things do change. And I will say this, though. Even with Night Seeker, what I try to do with each book is that each book has beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
And I'll say, oh, you know, and I will have like a little piece at the very end that says, oh, now it's just going to happen in the next book.
Right.
Just I'll have a lead in for you, but you know what you read is completing what you read. But the thing, I want to keep it more like Star Trek, like the original Star Trek, where every episode was beginning, middle, end. You don't have anything to tie together to know anything about the past episodes.
Right.
They're just complete stories.
Yeah.
Except for a two-parter.
An occasional two-parter.
Yeah, it was rare, though.
Like Mirror, Mirror, I think it was a two-parter.
Maybe.
I don't recall.
But like I said, your main thing with your reading audience or with your comic books that you'll make sure you have a complete story where when the customer is done reading that book, they feel fulfilled. And also a thing about my writing is this: I'm always going to say I want to leave you with something. Most books just want to entertain you.
Right.
With mine, I want to leave something that's going to resonate in your heart and your mind for the rest of your life. And that's why a lot of my customers love coming back and saying, like, man, I learned so much just from this one character. It really changed my life. Either they got back to church, they start eating more healthy, they start appreciating more people around them because, you know, of their feelings. And they got into it more themselves. And it's a joy knowing that people actually really get a high off reading my stuff. Not that way, but
it's a good high.
But when I have rabbis, I have Muslims actually want to talk to me at times. I said, look, I was told to read your book. And it's just funny. It's like, what do you mean? My congregation remembers my congregation told to read your book. It had a lot of meaning. And I see why now. Because you actually, in your first book, you actually acknowledge God. And you did it in a way where it wasn't dogmatic. It was just a very spiritual way of doing it. But you kept the book very rounded where it appeals to everybody in the circle. So as I said, that character is very, very different. And I'm not here to preach anything like that, but I'm here to give you something that is going to add to your life.
Right.
And it makes me totally different from all the other superhero writers out there. I want to make sure it adds something to your life. That's my purpose.
Kind of a non-sequitur question, then. It's a question. It was something I was thinking about tonight when we were at the award ceremony. And obviously you had your opinions about Marvel and DC and how they pick things. Ultimate Spider-Man, Miles Morales,
mm-hmm.
the new character.
Yep.
He's half black, half Hispanic.
Correct.
Do you see that as a marketing vehicle, or do you think there's some realistic depiction behind that?
No, my point is this. I said I will not read the comic for a while, and when it was first announced that this character was coming today,
mm-hmm.
I said, oh, it's not like a gimmicky marketing boy.
Right.
Everyone's like, Derek, let's just get it. I said, just for research for Night Seeker. One day, you never know.
Yeah.
Says, okay, look, I'll get the first 12 issues. I'll try it out. Just for that. First couple issues, slow, learning more about character. It was a little slow. They're nice though. They're all supposed to be cool.
Yeah.
Then when the sixth issue came out, and the cover was immaculate. It had Miles on the wall, on the brick wall. The mask was up, you see his face, and part of his midsection and back was actually the camouflage. And I said, oh my god, this is gonna be hot. And also Nick Fury finally gave his costume. I said, oh, that's gonna be that.
Yeah.
And when I opened up the book, what really depressed me, sorry to say, was that the artist changed, and it looked like a Sunday morning cartoon paper.
Okay, yes.
That was terrible. And I said, you guys meant for this to fail. Mentally, this is what I'm thinking. You meant for this character to fail. And I hate to say this, but at times I think companies do this just to kind of meet a quota. Is that, well, we did try a black character, we did try a Hispanic character, didn't make it. Sorry, not our fault.
Yeah.
Huh.
Hate to say that.
I didn't think about it that way, but I think...
Hate to say that.
Yeah, I mean, because when they change the art style of one of both too, that kills it a lot of times.
And like I said, again, it's his first time out in the official suit.
Right.
Yeah. And you're going to change the artist.
Yeah.
I would have just kind of asked the person that actually gave the green light to that book to be done.
Yeah. No, that's true. And it's funny because artist is very important. And I think the late 80s, early 90s proved that when you had people like Todd McFarlane on Spider-Man, and they were selling these outrageous numbers in the book because of the artists, not because of the great stories that were being written at the time.
Correct.
And, that was an interesting question.
They backtrack a lot of those stories.
You know, it's funny, I don't remember if I asked you about this or not, because right around that time in New York, when they also had the whole John Stewart thing of come and gone, and as an African American writer, what did you think of the whole thing? Because to me, it was like, okay, they said they were going to kill him, and we all know at this point when they kill off a superhero, people in the city is not to sell books.
Right. Correct.
But then the whole community got up in arms, and they were like, no, you can't kill him off; that would be wrong, and they backed out of it. Do you think DC was right or wrong for A, announcing it, and then B, backing out of it?
Well, when I found out about the writer leaving, when they saw him get killed off, and I said, no, it's got to be a stunt. I said, the writer would never left if he knew, if it was a stunt, he was going to actually revive him, like, two issues down.
Okay.
He never left.
Right.
They wanted him out. So... Sorry, read between the lines, they really wanted to kill off the character. I don't know what the main reason was. It was actually one of the better characters for DC Universe.
Yeah.
But another thing is this, though, is that I was never one for, and I hate to say this, though, we have a black character. I don't like hand-me-down powers.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's a hand-me-down. Right. Same thing with Firestorm, hand-me-down. Is it right now? Where are the original characters?
Right.
If you want to make a character of color, give me someone original, please.
Right.
And I have to say, Miles Morales, hand me down.
Yes.
It's still hand me down.
Right.
You guys couldn't create an original character for the black community? Really?
Yeah.
Really?
No, I mean, that's one of the things that bothered me about...
even Nick Fury.
Well, yeah, even Nick
Fury. Also, yes.
Right, exactly. Like, that's what bothered me about it. It's like, you know, to me, Peter Parker's always Spider-Man, you know. And it's like, okay, you can come off. But then, just create a new character.
Right, it doesn't have to be Spider-Man. It could even be a parallel to Spider-Man, but it doesn't have to be Spider-Man.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's, you know, plenty of other ways it could go. You know, a play on Venom. You know, I mean, Venom was a copy of, basically, an evil copy of Spider-Man.
Right. Yeah.
But, again, you can copy the character and make them different in a lot of ways.
Correct.
You know, because now his suit's alive, now it does all these cool things, and it's not, that's what gives him his power, as opposed to he was bitten by a radioactive spider.
Yeah. Right.
But you're right, exactly. If they're just going to it especially read as a stunt because, right, it's just hand-me-down powers. Exactly.
And I even take the next level. Everyone loves Iron Man. The War Machine. This is technology from Tony Stark. Gave him a suit.
Yeah.
Look at the military create, you know, a suit for him. That'd be Iron Man style, but it could be something a little different.
Yeah,
it's just things like said, it's the hand-me-down. Oh, I can't stand it. Yeah. So that's why I harp on writers of color and saying, please, it's nice that you love these other characters, but please start doing something original.
Absolutely.
Start doing something original. And own your own property. And that's another thing too, is that we would never, as far as the black community goes, we were never showed or told, own your own property. That's where your royalties come from. That is where your legacy will come from.
Right.
Is own your own and do your own.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, especially if you're a creator and you're in a position to own it. Own it. You know, I mean, it's funny because as a musician, I was on the edge of being signed a couple times in different bands, but you know, that's one of the big issues.
What? And then they mention.
But that's one of the big issues with being a musician is that you sign over all the rights of your music to the record company.
Yep.
It's not all yours. You don't own it, right? Like, yeah, you are known for playing that music, but you're not making the money off the record company.
Right.
That's why I do find it, you know, the world we're in today is very exciting, is you can create something yourself and own it and put it on the internet for the world to consume.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, for any artist who's listening to this podcast, I mean, that's the message you can take away from this, is that you don't need to depend on Marvel, DC, Warner Brothers Records, any of those.
Right. I mean, it's definitely become a bit of a democratization of media. And a lot of the electronic devices that we have today are allowing that. Like, you know, you see a lot of writers who are self-publishers nowadays,
right,
putting out, you know, only electronic versions of their books for e-readers.
Yes.
Because, you know, Amazon lets them do that. It's definitely a much more democratized process.
So
you see a lot more good media come out of
it. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, and there's the argument that now we're being inundated with more and more information, and it's hard to sift through the garbage through the good stuff. But I think the good stuff does rise over time. You know.
Yeah, it's literally. Yeah, and I've always told writers and artists that, look, if you believe in your product, you back your product.
Right.
You do these conventions. You go to panels. You moderate. I moderate my own panels. I love doing them. And you know, but every time I get down to panels, that I'm real on the panel. I said, look, I can say anything I want to say on stage. I'm going to respectfully and professionally. But when you leave this panel, you're going to learn something. Because everyone's from Marvel DC to do their own panels. There's going to be corporate talk.
Right.
There's
exactly.
All corporate talk. This is what they're told to say. And it's my panel. My panelists, they speak from the heart. They speak from their experience. They speak from the struggle.
Yeah.
They speak from the struggle. And every time I get down the panel, people come to our table and say, look, I have other panels. I never did a panel like this. This is totally different. I'll make sure I get to understand what you do. I said, because you are totally different.
I've been to panels at cons in Philly, and then go to a similar panel in New York like 2 months later, and they say the same exact things. Exactly, because it's corporate speak. It's not.
Right.
They're not speaking about how much they love the character or what they really want to work on. They're talking about what DC told them to say, what Marvel told them to say. Yeah, exactly.
It's essentially a joke.
Right, exactly. It's a press junket.
But I say this, if any of you guys can listen to this, if you ever get a chance to be around somebody at a con, and I tell you this, and the guy is so humble and so talented, George Perez, just an awesome, magnificent guy to be around. It reminds me of myself, actually. Always having a smile, always
he
does.
I back up that statement 100%. Dude, you two are a lot alike.
110%. I don't really have an idol, but if I say, look, someone that you want to be around is like me, you want to be around him.
Yeah.
You want to be around him.
Yeah. Yeah, you remember I was working next to the table.
That's right.
Helping out with that fiasco that happened at the convention. We won't mention it because friends of mine run that convention. But he's a great guy. He's always smiling, always willing to talk to his fans. But like you said, I think it goes back to the salesman thing. You know, he believes in what he does. He believes in what he draws. He's always selling his product. You know, mm-hmm. And when you're someone like George Perez, and you get to that point, he is the product. He's selling himself.
He's himself.
Yeah, and he does a really good job at it. You know,
and don't worry, one day he'll probably be in my secret world also. Where you know it, yes.
It was one of his custom made shirts on?
Yes, indeed. Probably like Hawaiian style or something.
Right. Yeah, for those who don't know, George Perez, all his shirts are custom made by his wife that he wears when you see him at conventions. So, if you've never met him and you're listening to this podcast, if you meet George Perez, say, your wife did a good job on that shirt. That's my little tip to you.
And also, she is also a belly dancer. Professional.
Oh, I did.
She teaches
that.
Classes.
Wow. Oh, okay.
Yes, indeed.
Ah, see? Learned lots of secrets about George
Perez. And now you know the reason why George Perez is so very happy all the time.
There you go. All right. We're a little over an hour now. So, you want the listeners to know about?
Upcoming projects. There is a new character working on it. It'll actually be mentioned. The third book is just about completed. The artwork's already being done, so it should be ready by July. Okay. It will be a mention of a character. I cannot say at this moment until the book is done and is, you know, mailed out to me and is copied. But it will take place these on the West Coast.
Okay.
There's none of West Coast characters, so I want to put something out there, but also it's going to be based in LA. So we're going to deal with the gangs and everything else. And this will be very in your face to the hilt. That's going to be great. Another project is called Storm Forces.
Okay.
This will be a space genre. I haven't done one yet. I did do a book for Deep Space Nine. It was called Terror from Another Side. I never published it. That was actually my first novel. I kept it because I wasn't sure what I really wanted to do, but I finished the book before I started my secret. I'm probably using elements from that to go into my story world that I do anyway.
Yes.
And the other project I'm working on with Sean Aline, we start this pretty much in around the fall or winter time after New York Comic Con.
Oh, okay.
And this will be let's put it this way, it's dealing with the undead. This will be very, The Walking Dead, everything else, they have their own version. We're going to have our own, and it's going to be very, very different. No one will expect this coming from a mile away. So expect everything I do, everything I touch, is going to be different, and I make sure of it. I stand on my word when I say I make sure that you will be entertained, but also you will also learn something from everything that we do.
All right. Cool. All right. So for everyone listening, Eric, thanks for being on the show. First off,
yeah.
This is Dave. Don't forget to check us out on superheroespeak.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. And is there anything to add, Ben? Make sure your capes are in their full upright position.
And I guess the last part for Night Seeker is if you want more information on Night Seeker, the best thing to do is go on the website. It's nightseeker.com, but night like a shining up, like a night shining up, so such a K. Nightseeker.com. And pretty much, I answer all my emails, so you guys can write to me anytime you want to.
Yes, the answer is most of them. All right. All right. Have a good week, everyone.